ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Since the early 1990s, countries have debated how to combat climate change, with the years producing several important accords, including the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement. But really, despite international commitments to reduce carbon emissions, as well as huge leaps in clean energy technology, the world, it seems, is still hurtling towards devastating climate change impacts. So, what does one of the key negotiators of the 2015 Paris Agreement think about where we are, where we should be, and where we're headed? Todd Stern served as a special envoy for climate change under Barack Obama, and he joins me now. Todd, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
You helped negotiate the 2015 Paris Agreement. What's your view on the state of climate action in the world right now, and which countries are lagging behind? And more importantly, is it Australia?
I think there are basically three main forces that are key to understanding where we are in climate change right now. One is what we hear from science, what we see, and the impacts are all over the world are getting, if anything, worse and worse on the one hand. But the second factor is that the technology story is really quite spectacular over the last number of years. Tremendous advances in all kinds of green technology, and that tells me that in theory we could get where we need to go. The third factor is there's all sorts of resistance still in many places, and the resistance is driven most powerfully by the fossil fuel industry. And so at some level, the issue of hearts and minds, of what people think and what people are willing to push for, is going to be, I think, quite critical. And you know, I think that's basically the way I see it. In terms of what countries, I think many countries are doing quite a bit. I think Australia is doing quite a bit. I think the United States is. Nobody's doing enough. China is almost a third of global emissions, and China does quite a lot in terms of producing clean, renewable energy, but also enormous amounts of coal that they're still producing and have greatly increased their building of new coal in the last few years. So everybody has a lot of improvement to make.
You recently said that, quote, we are slowed down by those who think of themselves as grown-ups and believe decarbonisation at the speed of the climate community calls for is in fact unrealistic. Maybe you could just unpack that for me a little bit. What do you mean?
Sure. Well, it goes back in part to what I just said, which is that the willingness and more the real determination of people to drive for what we are able to do, the sort of the human factor, if you will, where people are at in that regard is quite critical. And
but is that politicians or business leaders?
I think politicians worry about jobs and economic growth and the next election and all of those sorts of things, and that's understandable. But what needs to happen really is that we get to a point where politicians understand that not acting is going to be bad for their political health. Look, we are moving. I mean, if I go back to when I first got involved in climate change, all the way back to the late 1990s when I was working in the Clinton White House, and you compare that to now, it's dramatically different, but we're not going far enough. And when I refer to the grown-ups, I'm talking about the people who, not so much the people in the fossil fuel industry, because they're their own problem, but people who look and say, we're going to get there, you can't expect too much to happen too quickly. And that kind of mentality is not what we need now. If you would have looked at taking a comparison to the way countries treated COVID, if you would have said to countries before COVID happened that leaders could close down cities of 10 million people overnight, you would have been laughed out of the room. But the point came where they understood they had to do it, and it would be worse for them not to do it. We're not there yet on climate, but climate, you know, in terms of the damage and danger that it can produce, is everybody's bit as serious. So I think that the be patient, you know, we're going to get there, but not so fast, that doesn't cut it now, because we just, you know, it's a race against time.
I'm curious about whether you still hold optimism, because there is, I suppose, a pathway for the world to come together to cut emissions to net zero by 2050. But what very practical steps do you think need to happen, apart from sort of political will, and I understand those points, but what mechanisms do you think that we need as a international, multilateral globe to make that happen?
Well, in terms of the international system, you've got the Paris Agreement, which is actually quite a good agreement and works to have There are five-year cycles that require countries to keep ratcheting up what they're doing. That's there, and Paris keeps pressure on, but Paris can only do so much because at the end of the day, decisions get made on a national level. That is a core element of the Paris Agreement. There's no way that you can dictate to countries and force them to do things that they're not going to do, but you can put pressure on. It's improving, but not at the speed that we need. You know, I'll take you back to an example of the kind of way that sort of civil society and citizen engagement can have a big effect in things. And if you think back to the original Earth Day in 1970 in the United States, that was organized by people who wanted to take advantage of the activism of young people that had been going on in the United States for some time based on the Vietnam War and civil rights and so forth. A senator from Wisconsin at that time decided to try to start take advantage of that with respect to the environment. There had been a growing environmental consciousness based on a famous book that been published in 1962 and some dramatically bad events that had been visible to everybody. And they called for the original Earth Day, and 20 million people came out for events all over the country. And in short order, the Environmental Protection Agency was created, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and so forth, all within a period of 2 or 3 years under the presidency of Richard Nixon. That was what you had there, was a kind of tipping point in environmental consciousness, which created lots of action where it hadn't happened before. Again, I think that kind of thing, a building up of norms that require politicians and business leaders and so forth to take more action, is going to be critical. And in the meantime, there is a tremendous amount of good activity that's going on in terms of technology development and the number of companies and others that are stepping up. It's just that, again, we're in a race against time, and it's got to get cranked up at a faster rate.
If you've just joined me, Todd Stern, who served as a special envoy for climate change under Barack Obama, is with me here on RN Drive. I'm not sure if you've read or heard about Hannah Ritchie's book. She's a data scientist. Her new book is Not the End of the World. She sort of takes an optimistic tone, if you like. She makes the point that when her grandparents were in their 20s, the average footprint was 11 tons of CO2 per year. That's now down to 5, thanks to the way that the UK's carbon emissions have gone down in the last 30 years. She also makes the point that through global action, you know, we've averted a 3 to 4 degree temperature rise. She gives some interesting examples about how the crisis is being attended to. She doesn't talk about the next potential Trump presidency, though. I wondered if you could just talk to me a little bit about how you think Donald Trump may impact the US's climate policies and actions.
Well, look, in my opinion, there's no day more important for the United States, and in some sense, even for the world, than, I believe, Election Day is November 5th. It's enormously important because Trump will do everything he can to go backwards. I mean, we know that, and he did it last time, and there is the people and groups around him who are supporting his presidency a second term. Have laid out all sorts of policies in a wide range of areas and very much including climate. And I think that Trump would pull the United States again out of the Paris regime. He would try to go backwards with respect to all sorts of ways that the Biden administration has been very successful in driving climate action. They don't believe in it. He doesn't believe in it. They will do everything they can to pull back. Some of the things they'll try to do will probably be blocked in the courts, but it will be, if he wins, it'll be very unhelpful. I don't think he's going to win, but we've been there and done that, and we know it's not going to be good. And if anything, his people are going to be more ready and sort of more ready to hit the ground running if he's actually elected. But again, I don't think that's going to happen.
Here in Australia, our government recently announced its Future Made in Australia Act. It's more or less a bid to reshape the country's manufacturing landscape, to keep production onshore, to sort of compete with global competition, including the US's Inflation Reduction Act. What are your thoughts on this in relation to climate and achieving climate goals in this sort of policy sense?
I'm not deep into the Australian plan, but I know sort of in broad strokes, and I think it sounds like a quite good idea. I think Australia's got a tremendous potential to, certainly with the wind and the sun, to do much more. Australia, like the United States, still has a big fossil fuel economy, so moving away from that is obviously going to be crucial. So I'm all for the basic thrust of what I've seen. You know, I also think there's been a lot of talk and a lot of consideration in many countries, certainly in the United States, I think in the EU, I think in Australia as well, about the need to diversify supply chains, the supply chains that provide all the critical minerals for producing green products, clean energy products. I think the concern that a lot of people have had is there is, you know, one country to their credit up to a point, but with danger if it becomes a monopoly, and that's China. China's been extremely successful in producing and processing critical minerals that are needed for clean energy products and to produce the, you know, fully manufactured products as well. That's all, again, very impressive, very important for the world generally, but it's also important not to have just one supplier. And I think that there's a lot of sensitivity to that in many places. I think Australia has a big role to play here, given its manufacturing capacity, its the access of the critical minerals that are found in Australia, and its capacity to be a big player here. I think Australia, the United States, the EU are all going to be Japan, probably all players in driving this in the right direction.
Wonderful to get the chance to pick your brain, a special envoy for climate change under Barack Obama, Todd Stern. I appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thanks so much, Andy. Appreciate it myself. Thanks.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music, and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.